The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
Hi, I'm Michael Kovnat, and this is The Next Big Idea Daily, the show that asks for only 10 to 15 minutes of your day and in return offers up nuggets of wisdom from leading nonfiction writers, ideas both big and small. Today, we're going to tackle one of the biggest. What is sentience? It's a question that feels especially pressing now that artificial intelligence has introduced us to chatbots that can pass themselves off as conscious agents. Maybe now's a good time to hear these big ideas from Sentience, The Invention of Consciousness by Nicholas Humphrey. Nicholas is a theoretical psychologist based in Cambridge who studied human and animal intelligence for decades. In his new book, he sets out to solve the so-called hard problem of consciousness. No small task. Here's Nicholas.
I think this is a book about what matters most in the world. It's about the nature of sentient experience, what it's like to be conscious of the sensation of redness or sweetness or pain. I've tried to answer the big questions. What brings these conscious feelings into existence, and which animals other than humans experience them? These are questions on which scientists and philosophers are deeply divided. Some think all living things are sentient, some that only humans are. Some believe intelligent machines soon will be sentient. Some that sentience is a basic property of matter. They can't all be right. We want to discover what the truth is for two reasons. One is simply to fill in the picture of the world around us. It's intellectually provoking not to know the facts about what lies beneath the surface of other creatures' lives. We want to lift the veil. But the other reason is a weightier one. We want to know who or what else is sentient so as to know where our moral obligations lie. Is it immoral, for example, to boil a lobster alive? If the lobster consciously feels pain, then yes, it must be. If it doesn't, then no, it needn't be. We don't worry about the morality of boiling a cabbage alive. How does sentience relate to perception? Let me tell a story. 50 years ago, when I was a PhD student in Cambridge, I got involved in a research project that changed my life. There was a monkey in our lab called Helen, who'd undergone surgery that removed the visual cortex of her brain. When I first met Helen, a year after the operation, it appeared she'd been rendered completely blind. But I was curious. There are other animals, frogs, for example, that have no visual cortex to start with, and they can see perfectly well. Then why not Helen? So while my supervisor was away at a conference, I took the chance to investigate further. I sat with Helen and played with her, offering her treats for any attempt to engage with me by sight. And to my delight, she began to respond. Within a few hours, I had her reaching out to take a piece of apple that I waved in front of her. Within a week, she was reaching out to touch a small flashing light. And this was just the beginning. 5 years later, I had her running around a complex arena, deftly avoiding obstacles, picking up peanuts from the floor. A casual observer might have thought her sight had now returned to normal, yet I had reservations. I found it hard to put my finger on what was wrong, but my hunch was that Helen herself still doubted she could see. She seemed strangely unsure of herself. If she was upset or frightened, her confidence would desert her, and she'd stumble about as if in the dark again. In fact, we were on the verge of a remarkable discovery. We discovered that a human patient, who'd become blind after damage to the visual cortex, could also see in a way he himself didn't believe in. He denied he had any visual sensations, but he could still guess the position, shape, and colour of an object in front of his eyes. It seemed he had unconscious vision. Blindsight, as we called it later. The discovery of blindsight was theoretically shocking. No one had ever expected there could be any such dissociation between perception and conscious sensation. Yet, as I ruminated on the implications of this for understanding consciousness, I found myself asking a question out of the left field. If it's possible to see after losing the capacity for experiencing visual sensations, then whatever is the point of having the sensations to begin with? It became the question that's kept me busy these 50 years. What is sentience for? Some people say that we've no warrant to ask what sentience is for. Why does it have to be for anything? But that's never made sense to me. I'm an evolutionist at heart, actually an evolutionist at head as well. So I've always assumed that sentience is a biological trait that has arisen by Darwinian natural selection. However, a trait can only be selected if it's useful to the animal, if it helps it in the struggle for survival. If sentience has evolved, it can't just be a superfluous decoration. It must be making a significant difference to how the animal lives in the world. This may seem obvious when I put it this way, but it certainly hasn't been obvious to everyone. As you probably know, there are philosophers who argue that sentience is a purely private phenomenon that makes no difference at all to how a person or animal behaves in public. They suggest there could in fact be unconscious zombies living among us, beings who have no conscious feelings but who behave in every respect like conscious humans do. Still, evolutionary theory tells us this just can't be right. And this is the crucial insight that runs through my book. If sentience has evolved, it must be making a difference that can be detected from the outside. If natural selection can see who is sentient and who isn't, then presumably so too must a scientist be able to, if only he looks in the right place. So where should we be looking? Suppose frogs in fact aren't sentient. What can monkeys and humans do with sentience that frogs cannot? In the early 1970s, I became friends with Diane Fossey when she was in Cambridge writing up her doctoral dissertation about mountain gorillas. Diane invited me to visit her camp in the Virunga Mountains of Rwanda to observe the gorillas for myself. What immediately struck me was their huge skulls, huge brain cases. And that set me thinking about how intelligent these animals must have been when they were alive. I naturally assumed that gorillas must be using their high intelligence to solve all the practical problems of living in the forest. Once I was able to observe them, however, I was in for a surprise. For the fact was, the gorillas' lives seemed to be remarkably unproblematical. Food, abundant and easy to harvest, few, if any, predators, little to do, in fact, and little done, but eat, sleep, and play. As far as I could see, the gorillas had no need for their large brains. Yet in that case, why did they have them? It didn't make sense. I realized there had to be some crucial feature of their lives I was failing to pick up on. And then it dawned on me. While the physical environment might not be taxing their intelligence, family life certainly was doing so. Every day, the gorillas faced endless problems in managing their social relationships with other individuals, maintaining friendships, resolving quarrels, standing up to rivals, and so on. I realized that to keep ahead of the game, these animals must have to be psychologists. They need to be able to read each other's minds. Now, we humans have a special way of mind reading. What we do is we imagine how we would feel if we were in the other's place. So perhaps that's how gorillas do it too. But here's the thing, you can only imagine what it's like to be someone else if you first know what it's like to be yourself. And for that, of course, you have to be a conscious, sentient being. I'd come from working with Helen in the lab, Helen who no longer knew what it's like to see. Now, among the gorillas, I was getting a promising answer to the question of what's the use of knowing what it's like to see or hear or taste or feel pain. It allows you to gain psychological insight into other minds. If frogs haven't evolved to be sentient, perhaps it's because in the world of frogs, there's no call for doing psychology. How far does sentience extend in the animal kingdom? I think we have to set a high bar. According to the evolutionary story I've told, sentience is far from being a primitive characteristic. And there are two conditions for it to evolve. First of all, the animal must have a sufficiently sophisticated brain to imbue sensations with their impressive subjective qualities. Blindsight suggests that this may require a structure like the visual cortex. But next, and crucially important, the animal must lead the kind of life where there's a real advantage to having a firm sense of self founded on the experience of sensations. This brings me to a conclusion that many people will find surprising and possibly unwelcome. I reckon sentience is a rather recent evolutionary innovation. By far the majority of animals on Earth have neither the brains nor the use for it. To stick my neck out, I'll be more specific. I suspect that sentience may not have arrived until the evolution of warm-blooded animals, mammals and birds, around 200 million years ago. Elephants, dogs, parrots, we can be sure of. Earthworms, ants, lobsters, not a chance. Octopuses, they are everyone's favourite example of an exotic animal that's sentient. I'd say the evidence belies it. Octopuses show no signs of reveling in sensations as, say, chimps or dogs or ravens do, nor of having a strong grasp of themselves as individuals, nor of being capable of mind reading. Suppose we could, in fact, genetically engineer an octopus to experience sensations like we humans do. I believe their enhanced sense of self, of being me, would make little or no difference to the octopus's survival. The new genes would be wasted, and so would soon disappear.
Thank you, Nicholas. All right, people, I hope that was deep enough for you. Tomorrow, we're going to turn our attention to a more practical concern, the problem of unfairness in the office. We'll hear from the authors of You Should Smile More, How to Dismantle Gender Bias in the Workplace. They're a group of executives who call themselves the Band of Sisters, and they've got some practical ideas for making work better for women and men. I'm Michael Kovnat. See you tomorrow.